the conflict at Pittsburgh, more precisely at Clareton, Trinity Lutheran Church, Clareton, Pennsylvania, in the West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania Synod of the LCA. I may not have gotten the terminology exactly right. I think it's probably Western Penn, West Virginia, because I'm not an LCA person, and the only connection I have is that the Reverend D. Douglas Roth, the only connection, the initial connection, is that the Reverend D. Douglas Roth, who has been the one person that you've seen most on TV or heard about, was my student at Seminex, and is my friend. But I have not been out to Pittsburgh or been involved in what's going on out there. I've heard from just casual conversation with some of the folks so far this week that some people know quite a bit about just sort of the news items. Other people have barely heard of it. Some folks have heard of it but don't exactly know what it is. And I'm going to try to take a few minutes and give a little information. Since I told you that Doug is my friend, you know that you're getting, in some sense, a partisan report, although I'm going to try to be as objective as I can. And one way that I thought I could be objective was not to talk so much myself initially, but just read from printed documents. That's a little bit boring, but the information is there and it's more condensed that way. And so if you can stay awake for 15 minutes, I may have it all done then, and I mean, open up the, you know, then the can will be open and you can, you know, let the worms run where they may or do whatever you want. The most recent thing I have seen or heard was in the Wenatchee world that was here in the reading room when we arrived on Saturday. And there was this article about 8 column inches with Pastor Roth's picture, and I'll just read that to you. The headline says, "Rebel pastor defrocked, comma, then arrested." Greenville, Pennsylvania, Associated Press. Leaders of the Lutheran Church in America voted today to defrock a rebel minister who defied his superiors in a campaign to punish, quote, corporate evil, quote, for the unemployment situation in the Pittsburgh area. And he was arrested shortly thereafter for refusing to leave the convention stage. Paragraph. After the delegates decided his fate by a 499-33 standing vote, D. Douglas Roth strode to the stage and grabbed the microphone, declaring, "Here is the truth. We have had a railroad situation long enough." Paragraph. The delegates yelled for him to sit down. A few of them crying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Paragraph. "There is great corruption in the church," Roth said. Paragraph. The denomination's national leader, Bishop James R. Crumley, whose subordinates fired Roth from Trinity Lutheran Church in Clareton after Roth's parishioners complained about his activities, Bishop Crumley ruled the minister out of order. I happen to know that Bishop Crumley, the national bishop of the LCA, was in the chair at the convention because Bishop Kenneth May was in the hospital having undergone surgery a few days before and was still under recuperation. Bishop Kenneth May of the Western Penn, West Virginia Synod is the one who originally had taken disciplinary action against Douglas Roth, who is under his episcopacy, under his bishop role. Paragraph. "Out, out, out," the delegates chanted before walking out of the convention hall themselves and leaving Roth and one supporter standing alone on the stage. Roth and his one supporter, the Reverend William Rex Jr. of Monroeville, Pennsylvania, were arrested by Greenville police and state police shortly thereafter because they refused to leave the stage at Thiel College where the convention was being held. It was only the second time in the 23-year history of the 3-million-member church that a pastor has lost his standing as clergy through the disciplinary process. Roth, 34, was arrested last November at the altar of his church in Clareton, 20 miles south of Pittsburgh, after he defied his court-backed firing. He was jailed for 112 days for civil contempt of court. That's the most recent piece of news I've heard. Elmer, you were out into the other world over the weekend, or the last couple of days. Did you hear any more?
Nothing.
One of the biggest problems that folks like us who aren't there, and even I at St. Louis, who am 2,000 miles closer than we are here, but still 700 miles from Pittsburgh, give or take, one of the difficulties in finding out what's going on at Pittsburgh is that there is actually a conflict about what the issue is at Pittsburgh. You know, one of the issues of the Pittsburgh controversy is just what is the issue going on here at Pittsburgh? And in order to let you get a feel of that, I will read you a few paragraphs from Bishop James Crumley's recent two-page statement in the most recent issue of the Lutheran, the house organ of the LCA, June 5, where he addresses this the clerical issue. And then I'll read you about five or six paragraphs also from the so-called Pittsburgh Confession, a statement called Confession, not so much in the sense of confession of sins, but confession like the Augsburg Confession that the Pittsburgh pastors made in February about why they were doing what they were doing and why they thought Jesus Christ encouraged them, in fact, called them to do that. Maybe I should do it the other way around, though, because that theirs was first in February, and then I'll read Crumley's, which just is a week old. An Evangelical Confession, Pittsburgh, 1985, and the actual date is February 16. I'll read, I'll just read this first page. There are five paragraphs and then one line. At certain critical times in the life of the church, it becomes necessary to make a confessional stand. These are times when believers must profess the gospel of Jesus Christ concisely in order to call the organized churches and their leaders away from their embrace of, quote, another gospel, as St. Paul says in Galatians. These are times of great stress in the churches due to widespread social or political turmoil in the world around us. These are also times when there is a crisis of authority in the churches due to the fact that secular authority in some form has begun to eclipse the gospel. Furthermore, when such situations prevail, those believers who respond to the call to confess the gospel always face the wrath and the retaliation of that secular authority which has invaded the church and which can, at this point, use its structures to carry out retribution for its own preservation. Paragraph 2. A confessional crisis involves more than the simple ignorance or errors of church leaders. There always are errors in the judgment and leadership of bishops and pastors and lay people. We are all human and subject to mistaken judgment, to folly, to wicked motives. However, such errors can be identified, exposed, and corrected on the basis of a commonly held interpretation of Scripture and Lutheran confessions, namely, the Gospel. Paragraph 3. A confessional crisis, on the other hand, occurs when churches, through their leaders, willfully and consciously adopt another Gospel which justifies attitudes and actions in the church that would otherwise stand condemned in the light of the pure Gospel of Jesus Christ. In such a case, the gospel itself has been usurped by a false message backed by an alien secular authority. Paragraph. Such is the crisis now before us in Pittsburgh. Efforts of evangelical Christians in this area of massive unemployment to bring the word of God into the lives of the oppressed and to address that word to the oppressors, these efforts have evoked from church leaders responses which leave us no choice but to take a confessional stand. The words and deeds of our leaders clearly indicate that they have willingly allowed the, quote, business corporation to become an, quote, idol, an authoritative model necessary for the unity of the church. Paragraph 5. The influence and power of this corporation idol have become particularly clear in two aspects of our leaders' teachings and actions. Church leaders have shamelessly said that there are areas of life in the church where the lordship of Christ is not sufficient for the unity of the church and where the agents of the corporation have rightful authority. These leaders also have said that it is not proper for the people of the church to point out evil and injustice in the powerful corporations, thus denying, out of deference for these idolized principalities, denying that the word of God as God's law condemns the sin of all and calls all to repentance. Final paragraph, this is just the introduction. To recall the church's leadership from these dangerous expressions of an alien gospel and willing to take the risk of the consequences, we must boldly and unequivocally affirm the following evangelical statement. And then comes 2.5 more pages that are really just two main statements and then carrying out. And I'll just read you those two statements. Each is only 3 lines long. Statement number one, I should tell you. The two statements are one about the problem within the church, in this case primarily the LCA and the inner churchly conflict. And then statement number two is the sort of the problem out there in the world about unemployment and U.S. Steel and economics and that stuff. So for number one, the problem within the church, they say, the one Lord of the church is Jesus Christ, as attested in the Holy Scriptures and in the confessions of the church, and as made present to us by the Holy Spirit. He is the effective authority of the church, whom the church serves in all matters, temporal as well as spiritual. And then their second major statement about the world, and specifically the Pittsburgh problem, unemployment world. All creation in its fallen state is subject to the law of God, which calls for justice for all people and repentance of sin. For the sake of the gospel, the church must proclaim boldly this law in prophetic words and actions. That's the skeleton of it, and their grounding for why they say we got to do it now, this reference to an alien authority model in the church with an alien gospel in there holding it up somehow. So this was February, and now just a week ago, Bishop Crumley two-page article called The Bishop's Turn. Subcaption, Pittsburgh, : how we govern ourselves. 3 introductory paragraphs that have information in it, but I'll just move to where he talks about what the official church leadership, the LCA as an institution, is doing in Pittsburgh and why they're doing it. Some people are asking serious questions about the procedures of the LCA at Pittsburgh. Provisions of constitution and bylaws have evolved over the years as dedicated people have dealt with the situations they encountered. As an institutional church, we have been convinced that an orderly and systematic way of proceeding is far more productive than the chaos that so easily results when individual leaders do as they think best at the moment. Such procedures are not simply managerial accommodation either, but are also based on an understanding of the scriptures, on law and gospel, the nature of the church and God's mission as carried out by his people in faithful ministry. Let me cite one example, paragraph. In Matthew 18, verses 15 to 20, Jesus gives a process for handling conflict among Christians. The LCA Constitution is a way of implementing the principles laid down there. When one Christian has something against another, the two are to discuss it. That conversation takes place within the congregation. When they cannot agree, they present the case before 2 or 3 witnesses. That step can easily be compared to the committee appointed by the synod to meet with people of the congregation. When that meeting does not produce an agreement, the problem is to be told to the church, according to Jesus. This is the place at which the synod deals with the matter. Paragraph. A committee on discipline may have to be called together. 10 from the synod and 5 from beyond it. That's exactly what now has happened over the past months. The committee reports to the synod convention, and they reported to that convention that just happened last week, and the committee's recommendation is Douglas Roth should not be pastor anymore, should have his pastoral call revoked, and he should be stricken from the clergy roster of the LCA.
The committee reports to the Synod Convention, if the offender refuses to be reconciled and will not listen to the church, then that person is to be, quote, to you as a Gentile and a tax collector, quote, close. The time does come when the church has to exclude from its fellowship and depose from its ministry those who are judged to impede the cause of the gospel, either by word or by deed. The point is that the church in such an instance uses a procedure based on scriptural grounds. Constant evaluation of any process must be done to see whether it has been appropriately developed on such scriptural grounds. If not, it needs to be changed. But church leaders are bound by those provisions. They cannot, quote, suspend the Constitution and bylaws. And then there's another page, but that at least, if you will, sort of sets the flavor, at least makes a central statement. I'll just add two little pieces of information. About 6 weeks ago, April 3rd, yeah, that's over 2 months ago, the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago, which is a big LCA seminary in Chicago, the only LCA seminary that has a graduate program that offers a doctor's degree, so to a certain extent it's sort of a flagship seminary in the LCA. 71 people from that seminary, students, staff, and faculty, drew up a statement of not so much support for Douglas Roth and the other pastors as a whole group of pastors. You may have heard some of you that the initial DMS, the Denominational Ministry Strategy. That's a group of pastors in the Pittsburgh area who, 3-4 years ago, with official support from Bishop May, moved into a cluster group to go to work on the economic problems and see if they could, as church leaders and pastors of congregations, do something to help. What these folks are saying is we're not automatically saying these guys are right and the other guys are wrong. What we are saying is it is wrong to just sack this pastor, and two more now have been sacked since then, on the basis of the fact that they have broken some constitutional regulation. If that's all we church leaders do without paying attention to the spiritual, theological, religious issue that they are raising, and that in a sense is a statement of support, at least for the Roth group, to say what they're hollering about is worth hollering about. Whether or not they're doing it right, we're not yet safe. And they say the Synod Convention, for example, the one that just did this, ought not depose him just by virtue of the fact that this committee recommends it. They should take a look at the spiritual, theological, religious issues that are at stake. Now I'm about to throw in the last one. This was in the newspaper June 5, Wednesday of last week, when we left St. Louis. It says, attempt to defrock Lutheran pastor snarls planned merger. Dispute erupts between two denominations of the Lutheran Church. The attempt to defrock a Lutheran pastor for his pro-labor confrontational activities in Pittsburgh has erupted into a dispute between two merging Lutheran denominations. In recent developments, and then here's just a bunch of facts. Number one, the LCA has warned the St. Louis-based AELC against accepting any defrocked pastors from the Pittsburgh area into the AELC clergy roster. Number two, 51 LCA congregations have asked for procedures for how they can leave the LCA and join the AELC. Number three, individuals in the LCA have sent $20,000 in unsolicited contributions to the AELC headquarters as support money for any ministers that may get defrocked in Pittsburgh. Those are just three pieces of information that most folks didn't know. But I do know that these are verified as factual. Okay, then comes the reporters interpreting that. The 3.2 million member LCA headquarters in New York and the 110,000 member AELC headquarters in St. Louis, together with a third Lutheran church body, sorry folks, they don't mention you,
are in the process of forming a United Lutheran Church by late 1987.
The dispute involves a few LCA pastors in the Pittsburgh area who have aligned themselves with a pro-labor group that uses confrontational tactics to try to persuade Pittsburgh's corporate leaders to revive the depressed area. One minister, the Reverend D. Douglas Roth, defied his bishop in the courts by continuing to preach in his church despite his suspension by the bishop from his job, from his office. He spent, this report says a few weeks, it was 112 days, almost 4 months. He spent a few weeks in jail after he was arrested inside his own church following a 9-day standoff in the church with armed authorities. LCA officials began their action to defrock the Reverend Roth, but the pastor appealed to the synod, appealed the decree for the, to the synod. The synod meeting in Philadelphia this week, no, it's a mistake, meeting in wherever that was, at Field College, is expected to vote whether or not to affirm the action to defrock Roth or not. And the action was overwhelming, you know, about 98% to 2. A second pastor has been suspended from his duties and has already spent 2 weeks in jail after he refused to leave his church. A third pastor has also been suspended. The feud between the LCA and the AELC erupted last month when the LCA's executive council sent a letter to the AELC's board of directors. Elwin Ewald, executive secretary of the AELC, said that the LCA, quote, expressed concern about the situation. Sources said that LCA officials were irked because they felt members of the AELC were interfering in what they saw as an LCA problem. They warned AELC leaders against interfering in the disciplinary process and against accepting as pastors ministers who had been defrocked by the LCA. And then a parenthetical paragraph. If the AELC were to accept a minister defrocked by the LCA, it would in effect negate the LCA's action, since the AELC and the LCA are to become one denomination in less than 3 years. Both church bodies sought to calm troubled waters through their communications vehicles this week. The Lutheran, official publication of the LCA, is referring to this issue, carried an unusual 2-page column by Bishop James R. Crumley, head of the church, and the magazine's editorial, in the back, which I didn't read to you, also discussed the situation. Both articles defended the LCA's action and neither mentioned the flap with AELC. In his news and notes sent to all AELC professional church workers, Elwin Ewald discussed the AELC's role in the situation, including the charges that the AELC leaders were, quote, improperly interfering in the internal affairs of the church. That's an LCA quote from their letter to the AELC officers. Ewald said that the AELC's vice president, the Reverend Dr. John H. Teigen, had met with Reverend Roth, a personal friend of his, and the LCA regional bishop, Kenneth May, in Pittsburgh. AELC Bishop Will Hertzfeld, from out here in Oakland, is he? Oakland. I say out here. It's about, what, 2,000 miles south? Pick a West Coast state, they're all alike. AELC Bishop Will Hertzfeld then sought a meeting with Bishop Crumley, at which time it was suggested that a third party act as an intermediary to try to resolve the dispute through negotiation rather than through the disciplinary process. This proposal, says Ewald, has not been accepted. Well, that may be more than you wanted to know, or that may just be enough to, you know, aggravate you or whatever, but for the moment, that's some information about the problems in Pittsburgh. I billed it as a conflict conflict about church authority, because that represents my, oh, I need some nourishment, but this will guarantee that I shut up in about 30 seconds. Because on that score, I think the Pittsburgh confessors are correct that to throw someone in the slammer because he won't obey your rule that he should stop being pastor at that place, even if he was, you know, the most gosh-awful guy, that itself, well, in my own language, quoting from the Bible, our Lord himself says, that at least shall not be so among you. And the Augsburg Confession, if you want to get more technical, Article 28 talks about the proper way to be a bishop according to the gospel. And the one thing the Lutheran reformers back there in 1530 said is, never there a bishop, according to the gospel, used the power of the sword in order to exercise authority in church affairs and to call the cops to put somebody in jail because he won't stop preaching at this church. Looks to me like, you know, a clean conflict with that arch-Lutheran principle. So, that's my perspective, at least you see my point of view, but the purpose of a forum is that we hear other points of view and we discuss things.
I've been reading quite a bit about it in the different publications, just kind of curious about it, but didn't it boil down to the point where he wouldn't leave the church? Doesn't it come to a kind of an ultimatum where he would not leave the church?
But he stayed on the church property and continued to preach Sunday mornings after his bishop had said, you are no longer pastor of that place. And then later on the bishop said, we are closing that congregation. And so, and his church council would not agree with that. So they kept on using the church building, and they kept on coming to church as though they were still a congregation. And eventually, the synod officials called the sheriff and had him arrested. And then Ross spent almost 4 months in jail.
So the congregation didn't vote to fire the pastor or anything like that? I guess I didn't.
There may be some LCA people here or just other folks who know more than that. I'd like to lick my ice cream cone for a while. Would some of the rest of you talk?
I got the impression that it was divided, that there was a smaller group than his group. And then there was a large group that didn't agree with him, and that's where the big conflict started, and I think it's gone in all directions from then on.
Well, I'm an LCA pastor, but you don't know where Oakland is, and we don't even know where Pittsburgh is. The issue has been debated and discussed talked about a great deal, but not a great deal of action or clarification has taken place in our midst. And we have assumed that it is being handled appropriately by the powers that be. But there's some heat has been generated in the matter. And I must admit that I haven't gotten all that interest in the subject. I'm just assuming that the folks back east who know that sort of thing do their thing and handle it properly. But this is somewhat to my shame. I brought a folder along of things to read at Holden. And one of the more recent things was the letter, December 18th, by the bishop addressed to me and all the other LCA pastors, church workers. And there are a couple of things that he says I think that may be worthwhile. The congregation was the church in Clareton was very sharply and bitterly divided within itself, and there were numerous appeals from that church. I don't know what the score was, you know, 20 to 100, 10 to 1,000. I have no idea, but there was a considerable division, and apparently a lot of hostilities were evident and obvious in that area. So that the thing was, there were appeals to the national church and the synod. But what Bishop Crumley, who was a really very evangelical man, I know him and have a lot of respect and regard for him. But again, I didn't get the last issue of the Lutheran because I'm out here, so I haven't read that. But let me, if I may,
open house.
Okay. Dear partner, that's all of us who work within the LCA. First, let me say that because of the complexity of the situation, and that's for sure, and the rapidity with which it is unfolding, no report that I have seen has given the whole story. To do so would require an entire book, particularly if the account was intended to be fair and balanced. Reports in the media inevitably create impressions that are misleading. We must be careful, therefore, not to make any final judgments on the situation on the basis of media reports alone. I think that the article in the Lutheran, this is the December issue, which I didn't read either, have been as accurate and informative as can be expected in so brief a space. I read the obituaries. qualifications.
Walt, if you're only 6 months behind, you're still ahead of some of us.
Right. I comfort myself with that. This paragraph, I think, may say something. The dispute between members of the WW, which is a Western Penn and West Virginia Synod, is over strategy, not over goals. I think that much I do know, that the goals that were intended and at first even supported by national funds from the LCA are still approved of. There are those who have said that the Synod is not interested in achieving economic justice, in assisting the unemployed, in ministering to the poor, and those otherwise suffering from the economic downturn in the Pittsburgh region. The strategy in dispute is that proposed by a group of pastors and congregations working together in an organization called the Denominational Ministry Strategy. That's a DMS. The DMS's program was begun by the Synod about 5 years ago, financed in part by Strength for Mission Funds, to which I contributed. So it was an ecumenical program involving Lutherans and other denominations to meet the needs of the people in the Pittsburgh region. The goals set forth by DMS relative to people having jobs and being treated fairly by employers can be applauded throughout the church. But as the program developed, those in the leadership of DMS began recommending and employing tactics which many supporters considered questionable. The tactics have been reported as deliberately confrontational and often personally hostile. A great deal has been said about that particular factor, the confrontation and the hostile approaches. The more aggressive DMS became in its tactics, the more people in the church were divided. Finally, early in 1983, the Western Penn and West Virginia Executive Board decided that DMS had lost effectiveness and withdrew its support. The Synod and Convention concurred. A number of congregations and pastors, however, continued to support DMS independently, among them Pastor Roth. After some parishioners at Trinity Lutheran Church, Clareton, where Pastor Roth served, appealed to the Synod for an investigation, the bishop responded. And then comes reference to articles of the Constitution of that Synod. When Pastor Roth refused to comply, the Synod turned to the secular courts for assistance. That is where things stand as this letter is being written. It is a sad situation, but one, to repeat, that has not developed over goals which DMS and the church share, help for the unemployed. Then there's final, a lot of reference to LCA, a Synod and National Constitution, and the final statement, we all have a part in this, and we need to listen to be patient with one another, especially where matters of conscience are concerned. We need to be careful about hasty judgments. I pledge you that I will do all that I can as Bishop of the Church to bring about understanding and reconciliation. This is a time when we think of him who came to reconcile us all, to help us to love one another. And so forth. James Crumley. Now that is a statement by him that's a half a year old, but I think basically it does represent in part the attitude of the National Church and of the bishop toward this particular problem.
And we got another LCA pastor. You might be getting to know first hand testimony.
Well, some of the events that were surrounded the beginnings of this crisis are interesting, amusing, and sad. For example, it has been reported to us that initially, of course, members of the congregation were unhappy with Pastor Roth's activities, and so they sought to present their case to the bishop of the synod, and at one point he or his representative initiated a gathering of the congregation on rather short notice. At that point, the church council was almost unanimous in their support of Pastor Roth, but the congregation voted to have him disciplined or to have a committee investigate his activities. Subsequent to that, a number of new members were taken into the congregation, but it was discovered that the members were also members of the union, and the synod declared that those people who had joined were unfit to be members of the congregation, and so they disallowed their their membership, thus casting the majority of the congregation back in favor of those who wished to have Pastor Roth removed. There have been all kinds of accusations about what DMS has done to various and sundry people. There have been accusations that the matter in which Pastor Roth assembled the church council in his favor was to excommunicate anyone who disagreed with him. And at this point, you know, those of us who sit several thousand miles away wonder, you know, what is the truth? And maybe it's all true, and maybe none of it's true, or maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle. But the thing that I find very frightening about this experience is that I've been absolutely sure that this is only something that could happen in Missouri Synod and not in the Lutheran Church.
Now you know.
And I can't believe that the grounds upon which he was originally disciplined was that he was creating disharmony in the life of the congregation. I happened to serve an internship in 1964 in Atlanta, Georgia, where quite a few pastors were creating disharmony by preaching sermons on integration. In fact, so much disharmony was created that after a couple of sermons on integration, that most of the congregation wouldn't show up. And yet, at that point, the Lutheran Church in America didn't have any problem maintaining and supporting and nourishing those clergy, even though they are creating tremendous disharmony in the life of those congregations. In fact, so much so that the congregations, many of them disappeared off the, I guess the pastor would come and preach to his wife and children on Sunday morning, and one or two other well-meaning folk. So one has to believe that there are some much, much deeper issues here that are afloat and afoot. I'm sure God didn't create this mess, but maybe we can learn something out of it. Maybe we, as we move towards a new church, can learn something about the issues of power and how careful we need to be and how well acquainted we need to be with those issues if we're not to find ourselves in some traps that we don't want to find ourselves in down the road. Jerry, have you been closer to this situation? We have another LCA thing.
I really like to speak up because I've missed a whole bunch of stuff, but yeah. I'm Jerry Pedersen. I'm an LCA pastor from Southern California.
Is that Oakland or
in Park? That's even farther.
That's down there. In Mission Viejo, which is a white suburban parish in Orange County, the most conservative in all of the United States, so my credentials are good. The issue that they were trying to raise in Pittsburgh was, how does the church speak to a society using its resources to aid the unemployed, the poor, looking after the needs of people, when there's immense resources, even though there's some difficulties in working the industry so that people are employed? How do we use our monies and our resources to that end? The pastors involved are arrogant, obnoxious, difficult to live with, and the church solved the problem not by dealing with the issue, which is how does the church speak to a very bad situation, but rather they dealt with the issue, how do you maintain harmony in the church, because the church must survive. After all, the Sabbath was made, you know, by the church, the rules, something about a sermon tonight. And the immensity of the problem of dealing with justice and injustice and was too great for them. All they could deal with, seems to me, was how do you keep unity in the house so that you can continue to function and get along? And every letter that came from the bishop of the synod, and then the letters that have come from the bishop of the LCA, are people who are sensitive, they caring, but their caring has been for the survival and the harmony within the church, rather than addressing the problems out there in the world in which they exist. And they've solved it about the only way they know how to solve it and keep some kind of harmony and peace. It's a total cop-out, though, on what the church is called to do.
But don't you think that it was, from my reading, I think that everybody was agreed on the goals that they started out for, to attain, but it was the method that were being used, confrontation against the employers and whatnot, rather than try to work some other method than direct confrontation. Isn't that involved in his methods? I've read articles where he condemned the employers and whatnot. I've been a manager of a pretty good sized factory for many years. Of course, I left that 5 years ago, but I've worked on the employer's side, and I've also been a worker, so I've worked with unions and against unions, not against them, but... I was working with the board of directors and managing the company and trying to keep harmony around, and so I've worked on both sides of it. So my view, just from my reading as a bystander, has been that it was the method that he used, of confrontation, that caused a lot of the friction in the church. Then the church thought, well, now we have to go out and get rid of that confrontation and try and bring the members together, and they thought that kicking him out would solve the problem. But now it's spread, so it's become a big problem. That's the way I understand
it. It seems to me that had happened, as I recall reading of it a couple years ago, that they tried to do this thing, tried to work within the system, and weren't accomplishing anything. Mm-hmm. Now you guys in the LCA can vouch for either for or against. My memory is not that great anyhow. So, but it seems to me that's what happened. As I remember reading it.
They tried
to make some effort. The GMS.
There's so many industries now that are in tough shape. Steel is one. Yeah. Tough shape because of the economic competition, foreign competition and whatnot. So it is a big problem. It's a nationwide problem. We have it in the wood products industry too, and steel and many industries. While some industries are really doing good, some of them are really having a tough time because of our high costs, and there's many, many reasons for it.
Go ahead. I think it's important to point out that the concerns of both the steel workers and the unemployed in the Pittsburgh area haven't just been abandoned by the churches. I am from Pennsylvania, and I've spent the last couple of years in seminary in Gettysburg, where this is a hot issue and shows up on exams and things like that. and everything from ethics class. class to prophets class.
What's the right answer? You can tell us.
Well, obviously I can't. One of the problems, and we talk about this a lot, it was dinner conversation a lot, there's a lot of hurt and embarrassment. I'm not from that synod, though I'm going to it. But a lot of my friends are and are from Pittsburgh. A lot of them are from not that congregation, but other congregations in that area. And there's a lot of hurt and embarrassment. It's a very difficult situation in that what we see most frustrating is that the strategies taken on were not directly helping the miners or the steel workers, the people who are unemployed. And that plus the strategies were very disruptive to the worship life of a lot of the congregations around. There are a lot of the strategies became disrupting worship services of other congregations that had pulled out of DMS or had spoken up against the tactics that were being used. And in that we were embarrassed, especially because we are part of the body that was supporting Roth for so long. I think that the greatest thing that's needed right now is some sort of reconciliation. And I'm not sure how that will come about, but we need to bind up those wounds. But there is a lot of stubbornness on both sides, and no one's sure exactly what to do. There's a lot of confusion. And even for me, looking at it, the goals are good. But I don't agree with the tactics, and I don't agree with the way the Synod handled it. There's some sense of truth in what you were saying, that the Synod felt it had to address the leaders, the tactics that were going on, because that's what was most visible. And perhaps the thought was that if you wipe that out, then we can get back to the work that we are to be about as the church, and we can put our energies back into that. But the energies of that Synod, a lot of our energies in study or in talk were directed at what is this that's going on and how do we get out of it. And that's just not a real healthy spot to be in. But I don't know the answers.
I guess for me, one of the things that makes some things confusing for me are terms, tactics, strategies, methods, disruption, status quo, whatever, are in themselves, neither good nor bad for me. Specifically applied to a case. What, for me, I guess confuses me, what tactic was bad? What was disruptive?
Do you
need
to know specifics? I take that for granted. Some of the things that were done were going into the Mellon Bank, which is a big bank there that is not especially supportive of the unions and the workers, and also has other foreign investments and things that we all hear about banks and know about banks. Going into the banks and spraying skunk oil or throwing things on the floor, people, bystanders from the streets getting hurt on it, slipping and falling. Going into Easter services of other congregations and disrupting them. Those are some of the most...
Was Roth ever accused of doing these things?
Pardon?
Was Roth ever accused of doing these things?
He was involved in some of them, I believe.
That makes a big difference than the word tactic. Yeah, from what I've read, it's been limited, and what I've heard, it's been limited. So for me, that changes. And not having Roth here and not having the bishop here, of course. Many miles away.
Most of these
the violence of spraying skunk smells on bank walls is indefensible. Of course, the violence.
Why do you call that violence?
the violence of, well, because that's what it's, we suggest, those tactics of using that kind of confrontation.
The violence is when somebody, you know, sheds blood.
Well, it came, they avoided that, but skunks is bad. But the violence of thousands of people being out of work and being denied some of the basic opportunities of life, that can be glossed over. That can be lived with. That's not an unacceptable violence. I mean, that is an acceptable violence. But in fact, that kind of suffering violence that goes on day in and day out, how do we call attention to that other than by some kind of confrontation? Because the moment we stop confronting, we go to sleep. 15 years ago, the Black Power Movement said, we've got to confront the churches about racism and confront the nations and the universities and all. And they did all kinds of confrontive tactics. And people said, well, we agree in principle the goals that you're articulating, but it's the tactics that we don't like. So just stop coming into the churches and disrupting people at worship and these different things. And so the Black Power Movement, for one reason or another, stopped doing those things. And now we've gone back to sleep about the problems of racism in the United States, and the situation is now worse than it was 10 and 15 years ago. The moment confrontation stops, we go back to sleep again.